Hello. Thank you for staying. I hope more will come back in. It feels like at the end of the apocalypse, this is what's left. So we have a really interesting session for you. We've been scrambling some slides to take on some issues that were discussed today. And like Dimitri said, all of our thunder has been stolen. Like, everything's been said. However, there's some other stuff that we hope to share with you. So we're going to first have introduce each other, and then I'm going to share some slides, and then we're going to comment on the slides in real time. So Sweta, please introduce yourself.
My name is Shweta Sneha. I am the founder and executive director for healthcare management and informatics at Kennesaw State University.
Hi, I'm Steve Muir. I've been studying and teaching improvement in healthcare now for 30 years. I've worked at 6 different health systems, including chief quality officer at a system outside of Atlanta. I have a PhD dissertation entitled Quality Improvement Implementation in Hospitals. I teach at Rush in Chicago, and for the last 17 years, I've been attached to the hip of a database, a retrospective comparative database that Vizient has of 1,100 hospitals now that send us on a monthly basis all of their inpatient and hospital-based outpatient data.
And I'm Paul Barish. I'm an anesthesiologist, intensive care physician, researcher. I've worked in 4 continents, studied about 18 countries, advised several startup companies, and work with governments to help improve the safety and quality of care. So let's start with that. This is the 4 major reports that you all should be familiar with. They show the epidemiology of the fact that we harm a lot of people in hospitals and in the community, perhaps as much as 10%, maybe more. Despite all the work that's happened in the last 20 years, we still harm about 10% or more. Despite all the digital health that you've heard about this morning, we still harm about 10% or more. So we have some serious implementation gaps, which you'll hear about today. So this is the quadruple aim. You heard about it earlier. What I want to highlight here is this question that how do we actually deal with improvement while still enhancing the quality of life for providers? So how do we deal with this data challenge that you've heard about today and not burn out the docs, not lead to the massive increases of self-harm with drugs, alcohol, and suicide, and the resignation that we're hearing about? So Steve, you spend a lot of time across a lot of major healthcare systems. The crux of the quadruple aim, is it working?
Is it working? I don't know if it's working. So first of all, if you take a look at improvement, the improvement journey we've gone on, even before COVID, we weren't improving. If you look at observed mortality over time since 2019, observed readmissions, observed length of stay, complications, we're not improving. We're not getting better.
Why not?
I think that, you know, we've forgotten about Donna Bedian's very simple model of a structure, process, outcome, that if you have the right structure, you're going to then have the right processes, which leads to the right outcomes. I also think COVID has not helped it either. I mean,
what about if we have the right data sets? Won't quality get better?
Yes. One of the most important but forgotten steps in the data is that it's not the data. It's the insights that you can get from the data. And most organizations right now are getting data or information and not insights. Information, for example, comes in dashboards and scorecards, and they go to the leaders, and then we expect our leaders to understand how improvement occurs, and that's not happening.
You stole my next slide. So this is the father of every industry you've ever worked in, every car you've driven, every phone you've used. Are you familiar with Deming? This is the backbone of everything. We don't teach this in healthcare. This is the backbone of every industry. These principles of the client, the system, variation, theory, and leadership. Why is this so hard, Sweta?
Healthcare is complex. Healthcare is not one thing. So most of the other industries, I was sharing with you that before I came to academia, I was actually working with PricewaterhouseCoopers after my undergrad in computer science. So I was a student of processes and work systems and how they should interact. Healthcare is, those processes were complex, but healthcare is a conundrum. And I say a conundrum because it truly is one. It has health systems with one need. It has the payers with a different kind of need. And then the patients, which is one of the most underutilized resource in the health system. And then you have put in that mix, put the pharmaceutical firms, the clinical trial firms, and everything else with the health tech that's going on. And you have this mix of stakeholders who are actually pulling on what the quality outcome should mean for each one of them. So hence, the processes are not simple, and we haven't honestly spent much time understanding and laying out the processes so as to take it to the next step to improving it.
So my fundamental challenge to all of you is, do you think that you work in learning health systems? Do your systems address the fundamental building blocks of a true learning system? Steve?
I think that there are models out there that have worked. What I've seen in the 1,100 hospitals is we have systems that do well. So when I say we're not improving, that's on average. There are organizations that are improving. They're a minority, and are they learning systems? I think they're taking the complexity of healthcare and they're making it more simple. They're saying, how do we figure out how to improve
in spite of all of this
complexity?
So is it hype? Is all this stuff hype? The stuff we heard today about the EMR solving our problems, the gaps?
No, let me point out with the quadruple aim. The fourth aim is the staff, is the well-being of the staff.
Yes.
Brian Sexton at Duke's doing a lot of great research on understanding emotional well-being and emotional exhaustion. And what he's found is emotional exhaustion leads to and can predict almost anything you want in there. It can predict and help you figure out how to improve the health status of patients, how to improve population health, how to decrease costs. Right now, after COVID, our emotional exhaustion of the nursing staff in particular is at an all-time high
right
now.
So there's a paper published this week in the Society of Internal Medicine, SGIM, which shows that the burnout amongst physicians is equivalent to soldiers coming back from Afghanistan as it relates to PTSD.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. So I think this is the answer. I think this is one of the answers. What he found, Brian Sexton did, is that during the pandemic, when physicians were not allowed to go into the hospital and they used telehealth more, their emotional exhaustion actually went down, while the nurses went up.
Yeah.
Also think about this, the nurses support, the nursing assistants and everybody else, they're taking jobs across the street at the burrito place because they can get more money and they don't have to deal with patients.
So we'll talk about that in a moment. Is it just about money? We'll talk about that. So this is the advisory board arguing that, in 2021, Francis, telehealth was the key issue for executives. Not anymore. As if it's like a binary, one thing or another, right? So now workforce is the key issue.
It is.
Not telehealth.
It is.
So have we solved the telehealth issues, Sueta?
I don't think we've solved the telehealth issue. It's just that the paradigm has shifted to workforce because we've seen earlier the mass exodus of nursing workforce from healthcare is really crumbling the health system that was already on its knees. And one of the large health systems in Atlanta that we've been working with for the past few years, we are in the midst of putting this platform, which is a virtual nurse platform, much like taking or alleviating the exhaustion from the providers. We are trying to do the same for the nursing workforce so as to curtail some of the problems associated with it.
How many of you are surprised about the great resignation of nurses, honestly now?
No, none at all.
How many of you knew that we were treating nurses badly for a really long time?
Of course.
Let's be honest about it,
yes.
Okay? So let's not play this game that COVID suddenly caused this, okay?
COVID exasperated it, for sure.
We've been abusing them for a long time.
I mean,
I know that sounds like a really harsh statement, but that's not far from the truth.
Not far from the truth.
So we've just published one of the largest studies, 2.5 million patient catchment area. The number one reason why nurses are quitting is because they've been mistreated, not because they've not been paid well. It's because they don't feel they're being listened to. It's because they're being shat upon. It's because they're being ignored in their processes. So I love this slide. So, I mean, we've had these signals for years, and yet it took COVID to remind us we have a serious problem. Sorry, is this too much? I'm sorry. It was 4 o'clock. I thought I needed something to wake you guys up.
That's great.
All right,
I like
so it. Four questions. So what do we know about telehealth and telemedicine users? So let's talk about the human factors evil question. Yes. You and I talked about in the break.
Yes.
Let's talk about why there's so many issues around the lack of integration, lack of HCI, lack of human factors.
So how many of you have heard of this term called human-computer interaction and why it's important to any kind of tech dev?
Not one hand.
So human-computer interaction, and just to give you a very short, a very brief summary of that, is what enables certain technology and certain kind of applications and certain kind of software platforms to be meaningful to you versus being cumbersome. So how many of you are iPhone users, Apple users? Okay, how many times have you actually read an iPhone manual before turning the phone on?
I just talked to my daughter.
True.
I think that's a workaround.
But true. But you remember the first time Steve Jobs actually came around and really just slid his finger, and there was, and that's how iPhone was born. And that's, that to me is the zenith of human computer interaction. The zenith of
okay.
it. So for in my mind, if we can build health systems and telehealth systems which can be that intuitive and doesn't come in the way of actually taking care of patients, we will see a lot more adoption. So right now we have one-on-one communication. What we would like to see eventually in going into the realm of remote patient monitoring is that we are surrounded by sensors and they communicate with the providers without interfering with the patients, and that will actually improve insights gathered from the data and not just a whole lot of information coming from it.
I know you, but quickly, yeah. That's interesting, because isn't that the exact same thing we talked about EMRs 20 years ago?
We did.
And EMRs, I think, are causing more emotional exhaustion right now than...
Steve, we talk about patient-centeredness, and we had a great talk now by, I don't see him in the room, he stepped out. Do you think the system is centered around your needs as a patient, as a father of patients?
No.
Does anybody think the system that takes care of them is centered around their needs?
Nope.
So maybe we should stop using that term, because clearly it means differently to all the academics, including myself, who keep on writing this stuff, versus the, you know, what we actually feel in the system. Why is there such a gap between the theory and the practice? Why is it so hard to make it truly central around the needs?
It goes back to the question between medical care and health care.
So this is a lovely Canadian model, which argues that patient-centeredness begins with patients complaining, then we give them information, then we listen to them, then we actually consult with them, and then finally we do what's called experience-based co-design. Yeah. So co-design, what does that ring a bell when you hear that word?
It is truly to bring the users to the table before you start building something. I mean, imagine really smart scientists from MIT building a cockpit for a pilot without ever consulting with
pilot.
That's what we have been doing. That's how EMRs were launched. We built the first set of EMRs without ever consulting with the physicians. And of course, there was a little bit of a mutiny because of that.
So 30 years ago, Paul Batalda and others at Dartmouth, and Steve knows him well, developed this model called the clinical microsystem. Have any of you heard about this? There's an IOM report about this in 2006. The idea was that everything should be centered around the patient and the team, and these microsystems should have clear core values. It's a really powerful concept. You've heard about it hundreds of times, mm-hmm. And
it's still an ideal.
It's still an ideal. So this is from Paul Batalden, this idea that co-production means integrating the patient into the journey, mm-hmm. into the science, into the every step of the way, the co-production model. Why is that so difficult, though?
I think healthcare is, it's a large, gigantic ship that's very difficult to move. Now, I think COVID is maybe could
be the
accelerator that could help us, particularly with digital health and trying to get this to be more patient-centered.
So this is the science of human factors. It's been around for 100 years. Every other discipline except healthcare uses this regularly. It speaks to everything around the design of devices, interfaces, buildings, environments, organizational cultures, system architectures. I can go on and on and on. But the fact that most of you haven't heard about it is a gap in what we're talking about here, right? So what does that mean? It means if we're going to design for humans, we have to use the science of industrial engineering for designing devices. Again, how many of you use UX technologies for designing your telemedicine or telehealthcare devices?
We have a winner.
We have a winner. So this is the backbone of other industries. Why are we ignoring most of this in healthcare? I don't understand why. Every pump that we use, every bed, we use the same framework. Of course. So why is the healthcare companies are not utilizing these engineering skill sets? The steps are very clear. Needs assessment, solution selection, implementation, monitor and sustain. This book from Donald Norman, one of the forefathers of industrial design, argues that if you design a system to fail, guess what? It's going to fail, right? What does Paul Batalden like to say?
Every system is designed perfectly to get the outcomes it gets.
So are we surprised that our healthcare system looks the way it looks today? So this is some work that I've spoken to some of you here. So this is, I think, the largest trial of its kind. It's 5,000 patients. It's a project that we did at Methodist. Over a period of 3 years, we interviewed 400 patients and users. And what we're able to show is a variety of things. But most importantly, the readmissions at 90 days went down, the satisfaction of the patients went up, and the satisfaction of the clinicians went up. Does anybody know of any good trial that's shown anything remotely related to that? Which one? Okay. Fabulous.
But this is not exactly telehealth, so we're not talking about
data. No, we're talking about mobile health apps.
Yes, it's
yep.
A little bit different. So it's easy to evaluate, easy to build, easy to deploy and
scale. Easier, yes. Yeah, but the question that came up here, and Francis and I were talking about this before, so the company is called CareSense, and Methodist hired them to develop the technology, and then they hired me to be the external evaluator. So here's the question. Is it possible to develop a telehealth app with a company and not have biased results? Or is that by definition conflicted? Francis, what do you think? That's the beginning, right? That's not the end.
Yep.
Right. But then, interpreting the results of publishing is usually beyond what the IRB is overseeing.
Absolutely.
So part of the data that you ignore is
So here's another piece of work that we did. We realized during the pandemic that providers and patients did not know how to use simple telehealth, like where to put their face, where to put their microphone. Did you ever have these challenges in your systems? People couldn't hear it. Now, how many of you have seen examples or guidelines for this in your own systems? It's really interesting, because this is not rocket science, and yet, simple thing is where to put the camera, where to put the microphone. Again, simple human factors, simple environmental stuff. Okay, question number two. What do you need to know, Steve, about the system in order to make sure that the system around the patient and the provider supports the telehealth intervention?
Well, you have to, first of all, it was discussed earlier, but regulation, regulatory reimbursement can't be standing in the way to all of this. I mean, we have a real huge issue on our hands right now. Every executive team that I go and talk with, they can't find staff. They can't find staff internally and everything else. We've got to figure something different to be able to do this. And I really do think that this could work. It's just it has to be done, and I'm not sure how you can do that without some sort of regulation. But it has to be done so that it can get in and be used.
Sweta?
So I agree with you, Steve. I agree with you, Steve. But I do feel that sometimes the regulations get in our way of actually innovating and getting things done and moving the needle on it. But telehealth, I mean, it's been around for decades.
Actually 100 years.
The ATA has been around for 100 years. Yet, today we are talking about how this can sustain itself. I think that's a fallacy. I really think that we need to start having a conversation about how we can how we can have the right kind of money put into place, how can we support our physicians, and how can we support the quality outcomes part of the quadruple aim.
Let me ask you this. Okay, go ahead.
I want to respond to this. So this was published last week. The duplication over 1 year went from 33% of notes to 54%. 45% of EMR data was completely duplicated and of no use.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it took one clinician seeing 10 patients a day to go through 90 pages in order to get the vital information.
Yes. Well, I also want to say that, you know, the database that we run shows hundreds and hundreds of thousands of telehealth visits that were coded. And those have gone back down. We're a little bit up where we were before COVID. Why is that the case? Why did we not see the value of telehealth during COVID and continue to keep those telehealth visits up
where
they
were?
How did
the engineers who designed these EMR design a system where 50% of the data is totally
duplicative
and unnecessary?
Cut and paste.
Do your systems allow cut and paste?
I mean, those are workarounds, but we shouldn't...
50%.
I mean, think about it.
This
we
is not
really
the margins.
We shouldn't have those requirements which are not needed. So you're making things required. Like we had physicians going through alert fatigue.
So here's my next question. Do you know of any papers that have shown that EMRs improve the quality of safety of care?
None. Have you seen?
Well, there are papers, but I don't know if they're actually good.
In terms of... agree with that statement? So that's good. So we last year published, we looked at 583 articles, and we could find no real hard evidence based on a Cochrane-based, evidence-based model. So there was some evidence, I'm not saying there wasn't, but it wasn't particularly robust. It was a weak level of evidence.
That's
and,
what I thought.
And what's interesting is that almost all these studies ignore the U.S. HHS recommendation for applying human factors to EMR and to usability testing. Mm-hmm. So none of this is particularly new. It's at least 5 to 8 years where the FDA has given recommendations, voluntary, not mandatory, to design EMRs according to a certain set of standards, like you would a pump or a drug or something like that.
I do want to point out that when you're talking about the EMR effectiveness, we have to talk about against what. I mean, if it's against paper, of course, you know, most organizations, most clinicians probably say, I don't want to go back to paper. It's just that we have not developed, I think,
yes.
Sweta, what you've mentioned.
So is the problem that we just don't have
the
right research method, Francis? Is that the problem? That the EMRs are really, really effective? We're just clueless about how to measure it?
That's not...
Is that the problem?
I don't think so.
John?
Yeah. I mean, meaningful use 123 for our payment.
Care of the patient is better, and probably the Medicare Advantage model is a move in that direction, but we still have a huge complexity.
I was going to say the same thing. It's the EMRs are very well designed to generate a bill that will be supported, has all the elements that are required.
Absolutely. So now I want to move to another concept. So this is a fundamental building block of human factors. What it argues is that there's the work that the clinicians do. That's the work as done. Then there's the work that's imagined by the executives. Then there's the work that's documented in the record. And then there's the work that's disclosed to everybody else. It's not in the record. The gap in those works is the gap of implementation. Does that make sense? Sweta?
We wanted to establish best practices and we dug a little deeper, only to realize that the heavy hitter physicians, like the orthopedic surgeons and the others, they had hired what they called extenders. So yes, there was...
Oh, is this not working? So yes, there were a bunch of e-prescriptions that were going out every day, but it wasn't going out from the physicians as imagine or as it should have been, there were huge workarounds. So if somebody were to take that and build something on top of it, of course it would have been completely off.
And what about all the stuff that's not in the record, the processes, the decisions, that's not written down?
Yeah.
When I do investigations of adverse events, the EMRs have made it really, really hard to understand what actually happened because the language is poor, the documentation is weaker, so it's very difficult to do a forensic analysis because all that stuff, which used to be in the paper record, or at least some of it, is not there now. So this is Pascal Carillon's work from Wisconsin. What she argues is that if you want better outcomes, you have to focus on the social, cognitive, and physical environment that interfaces between the work system, the doc, the nurse, the pharmacist, their organization, their technology. EMR is over there. But if you ignore the processes, the social technical processes, it doesn't matter what you put in the EMR, you're never going to get consistently great outcomes. So that's the foundational building blocks of human factors, right? Mm-hmm. So here's what we do for that. We do process mapping and task analysis. Mm-hmm. Here's how we design our systems. This is what it looks like. Have any of you ever done process mapping? Every engineer does it. It's 101, right? Here's what it looks like, cardiovascular care. Here's what it looks like in the operating room. We've been doing this for 40 years. None of this is new. This is how every company that designs devices does, otherwise they can't get stuff through the FDA. We do mapping metrics. Imagine doing this for a telemedicine or telehealth device. Imagine that for a moment. I've never seen a company follow this way, or at least not talk about it. Perhaps they're doing it in secret, but this is how we design devices for rigor and sustainability. So, question number three, how do we integrate what we know, Steve, from users when we implement? So how do we get the user's input to understand the implementation challenges of the telehealth?
I think Sweta mentioned earlier, we ask them.
That's pretty novel.
Yeah. Well,
when do we ask them, though?
We ask them after we've already created what we're creating and selling what we're selling. And not, I'm not trying to say that we don't ask. We do ask some of them, but we need more widespread asks.
So this is something we wrote 14 years ago about the risk assessment that needs to be done in telehealth and human factors design. Are you guys familiar with this tool to design telehealth or telemedicine? It's a fundamental risk management framework that we borrowed from nuclear engineers. This is straightforward. It's required in other industries. Again, it's a foundational framework to make sure that by the time you get to a prototype, you've already addressed the risks and the hazards that are already based inside the system. Here's some paper that we just published that's coming out now in which we use FEMA methods. These are the methods that aviation engineers use to see if the plane's gonna crash or the escalator will come down or a ship will come apart. It's a fundamental engineering technique which is used, but now we're applying it to RPM around COVID-19 in Italy during the pandemic. All right, Sweta. What else to consider about monitoring and sustaining existing or newly implemented programs? In short, how do we sustain our telehealth interventions? What's going to keep it going?
I think the biggest would be if we can put the incentives into place, because our incentives keep varying all over the map. And that leads to, of course, you know, we have seen how physicians have been exhausted by alert fatigue. I'm hearing about emotional exhaustion. If we do not have the incentives put into place for our physicians and caregiving team, it's not going to be sustainable.
Yep. Our favorite guy. What would you want to say about him?
Vitas Tonabedian has the job that I've always searched for, which is he got paid to think and write his thoughts down. That's what I'll say about him.
So the Tonabedian model, he was a Lebanese who worked at the University of Michigan, who essentially was the foundational person for health services research. This is how we look at complex systems. And what this means in practice, and this is from a paper that we published a few years ago, that if you want telemedicine to work, it's very different if you change the policy, if you change the service, if you change the intervention. The more upstream you go, the less resolution, the less precision you have in the outcome. Which is to say that if you change CMS rules for telehealth, while it's good generically, it doesn't actually help telemedicine improve outcomes. Does that make sense? If you want to actually improve telemedicine outcomes, you have to focus on the interface between the device and the patient, not just on the financial aspects, right?
That's right.
So when you conflate these things, you get confusion between where you're investing in the process and why the outcomes are so variable. Here's another example. So this is this technique that we use. So this is a whole telemedicine device process. These are all the things that we apply in order to make sure that the device adapts to the needs and the barriers of the users and different type of personas, that's different type of users, young, old, men, women, children, etc. This is a very complex journey and it takes a while, but it actually works. It works all the time because you very quickly find out if the device is going to fail early on before you go to market. All right, implementation. We've talked about implementation, right? So this is a CFIR model. This is a standard model that we use for applying health services systems outcomes. Can you imagine if we apply it to telehealth and we find out what are the reasons why a telehealth device or service does not succeed? And what that means is we have to look at these things, right? Penetration, fidelity, costs. We have to look at efficiency and safety. And most importantly, the client, satisfaction, functum, symptomatology. Can we do this in telehealth, Sweta?
We could if we have the right kind of processes and right kind of structures put into place. So we've been talking a lot about the processes and how it interfaces and the human-computer interactions. Have you heard of this whole structure called the work systems method? So I believe if we can have the right kind of work systems, and work systems are not just processes, but it's a little bit beyond processes. It's really the ecosystem that has processes, technology, people, the workarounds, and everything else into place. And if we can have an understanding of the whole ecosystem, and we can put these structures into place, I think we can make it work. It's the magic is going to be in bringing everybody to the table.
So again, I ask the question: how do we make sure telehealth actually creates a learning health system for the patient, the doc, the nurse, and the manager?
Well, let me just tell you how the leading organizations are improving. Centralization and simplification. So, for example, if you want to do improvement efforts, what I'm finding in hospitals is that this department does improvement in mortality. This department does improvement in length of stay. This department does improvement in patient centeredness. They're all related. And so if
talking
you bring
to each other, sharing.
Well, they're supposed to.
Yes.
But if you bring all of that together, and I was just looking at this, there's some great concepts here, but you've got to translate those in a simple way to be able to, and in a centralized way to be able to get things done.
So who's in charge of all that learning?
Who's
collating it all? Who's making sure that
you
it's
mean the in the
executive suite or?
Well, there's a support. A centralized support group, typically led by the chief quality officer or chief medical officer, that should be the support for all improvement across the system. But we've
I
got
thought that's the CMIO's job.
Well, then when you go into most organizations, you've not only got the CMIO doing it, you've got the CNO doing it,
working
you've got
together.
The COO doing it.
Yeah.
Working together. Did you say working together?
Yeah, I did. So here's an example. We did this system. This is in Northern Italy. This is during the height of the pandemic. You've all heard that Lombardy system failed. Next door to Lombardy, the region next to it in Modena, using telehealth and using wide engagement of the community, were able to reinforce the hospital so they didn't fail. So telehealth worked here not just in the devices, but it was a social technical aspect. It was the community willing to embrace these things. It wasn't just the technology. So let's spend the final minute thinking about, in addition to all the things we've talked about, what do you think right now, what are the most important take-home messages to help deal with some of the barriers to adoption, the barriers to sustaining these telehealth changes? Sweta first and then Steve.
I'll start by giving a very small example of where I have seen it really succeed. So think about it. This is a study that we did on the aging diabetics in China, a population that's very very difficult to work with, I would say, because they had very set ideas on how they should be monitored or not, and we went through this whole exercise of collecting information about them, running through profile and persona, and then we created this platform that allowed them to be monitored, but at the same time, we created a social structure for them. So it's essentially, what that meant was every day when they were being monitored for a certain condition, they were almost getting gamification points with that. And they would discuss those points with their peer group, and then these sort of got competitive, and then they sort of wanted to improve their points associated with their condition. And that led to improvement, and that led to wide-scale adoption. So if we can build structures where there is social cognitive theory that's building a whole ecosystem of people where technology supports their outcomes, we will be able to succeed.
In the language that Steve and I, we would call that change management, right?
Change management is a part of it. It's not all of it.
Yep. Steve?
Yeah, the only thing I'll add is that with the right platform, I think the time is right now. So I think that small test of change will produce better quadruple aim very quickly, and we just need to do it, but it has to be the right platform.
Any questions or comments? No questions. No questions. One question. Dimitri? I agree.
And thank you for bringing it up, guys, today, because, you know, I think it's a treasure for health systems development.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much.
Well, as they said at the end, this truly is the